This is the Dutch International Service, Radio Netherlands.
The title of today's Media Network special is It Was 20 Years Ago Tomorrow.
Big L time is 3 o'clock and Radio London is now closing down.
Here's Jonathan Marks.
On Monday, August 14th, 1967, a number of very popular radio stations in this part of Europe closed down. They were offshore stations operating from outside territorial waters. But the British government had found a way of making it impossible for them to continue by means of an Act of Parliament that became law at midnight on the 14th of August. Dutch offshore radio specialist Hans Knot explains.
By this law, it was forbidden for British inhabitants to work for the stations, to advertise for the stations, to provide the stations with tendering, etc. Most of the stations closed down that very day, or some stations some days or weeks earlier. It was a very sad day. I remember listening to Big L was the last hour, was this all those artists who were very big at the moment make their last messages to the listeners and thank them very much for the many hours of pleasure to the DJs. Directly after that, I went on to 259 Meters Radio Caroline, which was on the air at that moment still, and it was Robbie Dale who took 1 minute silence for Big L, who was in his ears such a big station, although he worked for the competitor.
Offshore radio in Europe started in Scandinavia in 1958, while the Dutch station Radio Veronica opened in 1960. But British listeners had to wait until Easter of 64 when they heard this for the first time.
You are tuned to Radio Caroline on 199, your all-day music station.
Caroline was the idea of 23-year-old Ronan O'Reilly, the Irish manager of blues singer Georgie Fame, who was virtually unknown at that time. O'Reilly had become frustrated at not being able to get his records played on the BBC or Radio Luxembourg, and decided to start his own station. His father owned a shipyard in Ireland, where a motor vessel was equipped with a 10-kilowatt medium-wave AM transmitter and a 180-foot-high aerial mast. The ship anchored off the coast of southeast England and made its first test transmission on Good Friday, 1964. Radio Caroline soon received a lot of press coverage, and it wasn't long before thousands of letters were arriving every week from listeners. Advertising contracts were signed too, and Britain's first commercial radio station was an instant success. Andy Sennett was listening around that time, so what kind of advertising did they have?
Well, quite a variety, Jonathan. There was some from the government-subsidised Egg Marketing Board, and a well-known English duke even started advertising his stately home as a tourist attraction.
If you're shaving, I do hope you're shaving with a 7 o'clock stainless blade. It won't make shaving fun exactly, but at least you'll get a good clean going over, and you'll save money. You may need that money. Tonight may be the night we meet.
They were quite creative in 64. Well, others soon jumped on board the Radio Caroline bandwagon. In fact, one station was already in the advanced planning stages when Caroline first went on the air.
Our business is show business, and you're in tune with the showboat, the good ship Atlanta.
Actually, that station only lasted 7 weeks under its own name because a merger with Radio Caroline took place. The original ship lifted her anchor and sailed around the British coast, broadcasting continuously as she went.
Just me and Caroline, 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 Caroline.
There we have the fortunes and Caroline. Let's have a word from our friend Nettie on the other side of the glass.
Actually, Tom, I think we should apologise for some of the records sounding a little peculiar. It's because of the vibrations from the ship's engines.
7 minutes after eight on Radio Caroline as we sail west along the south coast of England. We're due to be off the coast of Beachy Head round about 10 o'clock, so any of you folks around there, do come and give us a wave. We're the ship with the big mast and presenting music all the time up until 9 o'clock tonight.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock.
4
Unfortunately, they didn't encounter any rocks, and after several days, the MV Caroline reached the Isle of Man. She anchored in Ramsey Bay and began broadcasting to Northwest England as Radio Caroline North.
Now then, hands up, anybody who can't hear me. Ah, well, you see, the reason is that you're tuned to 199 meters, and we're not. We're on 259 meters, so tune over to 259 meters in the medium wave band right away, 1169 kilocycles, because that's where we are doing our test transmission all the way through until 6 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Radio Atlanta, on the other hand, became Radio Caroline South, and the two stations served a combined population of about 30 million in Britain, with millions more in Holland and Belgium. By contrast, the next station on the scene barely reached the coast with its first test.
Hey, baby, your tunes are radio sets on 197 meters. The other station doesn't pretend to swing and doesn't pretend to be with it, but we really are with it.
Extrovert pop singer Screaming Lord Satch started his radio station as a publicity stunt. He occupied a disused wartime fort on the Shivering Sands off Whitstable in the Thames Estuary. But the station was very disorganised, transmission times were erratic, and the disc jockeys could sometimes be heard appealing for food and water or inviting people on passing boats to come and help run the station.
This is Radio Satch on 197 metres, medium wave. Well, now, you lucky people, if you'd like a request on Radio Satch, then write to Radio Satch, King's Agency, number 7, Denmark Street, London, WC2.
Satch soon got tired of his radio project and sold out to his manager, Reg Calvert. Calvert changed the name to Radio City, installed some better studio and transmitting equipment, and built up a modest but loyal audience. What Radio City may have lacked in signal strength and professionalism, it more than made up for with some highly original program ideas. Take this one, for example.
Hey, are you enjoying Radio City's programs? If you're not, well, how would you like to tell us why not? Or better still, how would you like to tell all our listeners why you don't like Radio City? You know, you can do just that on Radio City's show, The Anti-City Show, which comes to you every Saturday on 299 at 12 o'clock. All you have to do is make a tape recording of all your criticisms of Radio City, and you can say exactly what you want, and send them to us, The Anti-City Show, Radio City, 7 Denmark Street, London, WC2.
Andy, was that a genuine programme or just a joke?
Oh, it was genuine, Jonathan. It ran for several months, I recall. But I've never quite been able to work out how the station benefited from it. I can't think of any other radio station that only asked for hate mail, although I can think of a few that possibly deserve it.
Apart from the Shivering Sands, there were other abandoned forts in the same area. These became home to stations like Radio Invicta, Radio Essex, run by Roy Bates, who now occupies the same structure as the Principality of Sealand, and the smallest of all the stations, Tower Radio.
This is Tower Radio, testing the medium wave band. Transmissions will be subject to alteration and interruption throughout the day.
Big T, Big T, Big T, Big T, stay tuned!
Radio Tower.
Andy, what do you remember of that station?
Well, it never really got going properly. The signal at my location was very weak, and I don't think they can have been putting out more than a few hundred watts at the very most. They did have grandiose plans to run a TV station, and one individual even claimed to have seen a test card. However, since one of the station staff later admitted that they never even had a TV transmitter, I suspect that particular claim may have been alcohol-related.
There, I'm afraid the clock has beaten us. It's 10 o'clock again, and you're listening to your medical program from your good music station, Radio Invicta.
I do vividly remember Radio Invicta on Red Sands Fort giving out its weekly grocery order. About half an hour after close down, they would switch on their main media wave transmitter again and dictate their weekly order to the supplier in Whitstable, and that made for some bizarre listening.
Well, 1964 had its share of strange goings-on, but at the end of the year, Caroline had its first serious competitor. Radio London was to become the most successful of all the 1960s offshore stations. In fact, when the BBC started its Radio 1 service in September 67, designed as a replacement for the pirates, many people described it as Radio London without the commercials. Many of the presenters were the same, and so were the jingles. See what I mean? But that was only one of the many ways in which the offshore stations of the 60s have influenced mainstream broadcasting. The late Buster Pearson, a respected British expert on the offshore scene, in an interview for Radio Netherlands in 1984, saw this as inevitable.
Yes, that's definitely the case. People that were youngsters at school and college in the 60s are now in quite influential positions and have posts of responsibility in the media. When they do reports or write articles on the station, they are very, very sympathetic. And even the BBC stations, admit that Caroline brought about a revolution in broadcasting in this country. An immense amount of good feeling exists for the station. There doesn't seem to be any bitterness or anything like that.
Radio London, with a 50 kilowatt transmitter, was five times as powerful as Radio Caroline South. So when Caroline's ship, the Mi Amigo, ran aground in stormy weather, the decision was made to take the ship into port for a complete refit. In the meantime, the station resumed operation using a ship borrowed from Mrs. Britt Wadner, owner of the Swedish offshore station Radio Syd.
It was a Scandinavian project. Britt Wadner, the owner, who died last year, she hired firstly transmission time from Radio Mercure, which was on the coast also there. And later it became her own ship. She bought it from the organization, and Radio Syd became very popular. It was based, the studios, in Stockholm, and it was outlawed by the government in Sweden. But Brits went on with making programs, and also the vessel was still transmitting, of course. She was arrested, became four courts, and was sentenced to jail. But due to a law in Sweden, every inhabitant of Sweden is permitted to do their own job in jail. So a studio was rebuilt in her jail, and she made the programs there.
After refitting the Mi Amigo, Caroline had a new transmitter and antenna capable of competing with Radio London on equal terms. Operating at sea, the efficiency of the antenna is crucial. So what type of installations have been used over the years by offshore stations? Hans Knott again.
Most of the ships used a T-antenna or a big mast, mostly around 30, 40 meters high, one mast. And lately you see on the P-ship and also on the Russian Defense, a very big aerial, 90 meters high, very strong signal on it. If I listen nowadays to Radio 2, one of the Dutch services, on medium wave, and I listen to Radio Monique on medium wave on 963 kilohertz, the signal of Monique is in Groningen better than the signal of Radio 2, which comes out of the polders in Holland, only 200 kilometers away from here, and while the Rosary Fence is lying 60 miles outside the Dutch border. And the Dutch border, the seaside, is more than 300 kilometers away from my home.
Because you're surrounded by all that salt water. But one of the stations, Capital Radio, that had a very strange antenna.
They had a ring antenna. There was a professor out of the USA who said, well, this is the best to do on sea. It has been tested by Marine in America, and we will bring this and give a 10 kilowatt transmitter on it and have the biggest signal in the world. Well, this aerial collapsed several times. It was rebuilt and rebuilt. One of the ship's mates, his leg was amputated due to the fact that it came between parts of the aerial, which was very bad.
In 1966, an event took place which many believe was the decisive factor in the British government's decision to put the offshore stations out of business.
Yes, a dispute arose between Radio City's owner, Reg Calvert, and Major Oliver Smedley, who was the director of Radio Caroline. The two stations had a business deal which involved Radio City relaying some Caroline programs. Smedley got word that Calvert was trying to do a better deal with rival Radio London, and the two men had a violent argument, which culminated in Calvert being shot dead by Smedley. the negative publicity which this brought to offshore radio certainly helped to bolster the arguments of those who wanted them closed down.
But new stations were still coming on the air. That same year, 1966, saw another big radio ship. This time there were two stations on board one vessel. Despite the names, both stations were American-owned. Yet after only 8 months on the air, the stations went bankrupt. Buster Pearson explains why he thought Swinging Radio England had not been a success.
Yes, I think Radio England wasn't successful because it was ahead of its time. I think today, with the amount of American programming we get on television, people probably understand more about American methods in broadcasting than they did in the early 60s.
But someone must have been able to make money out of offshore radio, otherwise it wouldn't still be around after 3 decades. Who's getting their profits?
Hans Kraft. I think a lot of money has been made in two periods.
In the 60s, for instance, Veronica made in the late 60s a big money with advertising, with a good organization. Later, when R&I was attacked by a bomb in honor of the director of one of the directors of Veronica, it lost a lot of advertisers. Also in the 60s, Radio London made a lot of money, and Caroline in the first years too, up till early 1967. Later in the 70s, Radio Noordzee, the Dutch service of R&I, made a lot of money.
But what about now?
At the moment it's so that Radio Monique is not making profit, not getting lost that money.
Breaking even?
Yeah, breaking even at the moment. Radio Caroline has not many money to give out due to the fact that all those DJs are getting on the ship for £20 for 6 weeks walking, getting meal free, some days cigarettes, some days a bottle of beer. But there are people gaining a lot of money. Not the Caroline organization, not Ronan O'Reilly, but I think, for instance, the man who make all those contracts for the religious organizations.
By the summer of 1967, legislation to get rid of the offshore stations was ready. Despite huge public rallies in support of the stations, the date was announced. The broadcasters began to plan their close-down programs. Some decided to stay on the air until the last possible moment. That was 1 minute to midnight on August 14th. Others closed down earlier in the day, or even some days before.
Mike, Paul and the rest of them are not able to come out today to 270. What can we say? We've got two things against us today. What a combination, bad weather and the British government.
Radio Caroline decided to continue, despite the new laws. But in March of 1968, both its ships were towed into the Dutch port of Scheveningen by a Dutch shipping company, which said that Radio Caroline owed them money. For the time being, only Holland's Radio Veronica remained on the air at sea, until the beginning of 1970, when a new radio ship appeared. Radio North Sea International was owned by two Swiss businessmen, Erwin Meister and Ed Bollier.
Another day's broadcasting, Radio North Sea is now closing down until 6 a.m. Please rejoin us then. We broadcast on 220 meters, 1,367 kilohertz in the medium wave, in short wave at 6,205 kilohertz in the 49 meter band, and on FM at 100 megahertz.
The size of the R&I operation was its downfall. Soon after its start in January of 1970, accusations were made that its powerful medium wave transmitter was interfering with shipping traffic.
Changes of frequency were made,
but the complaints persisted, although no definitive evidence was ever produced. Then the British government started to transmit a jamming signal on R&I's medium wave frequency. Further frequency changes ensued, but the jamming got worse.
Radio North Sea moved to the frequency of 1230 kilocycles to 44 meters because this frequency does not cause any interference to emergency broadcasts or legally authorized stations. However, the British government has accused us of interfering with other stations, although no proof can be found of this, and certainly no complaint has been received by our offices in Zurich.
There was a general election in Britain that summer. RNI's owners, convinced a new Conservative government would cancel the jamming operation, started urging its listeners to vote Tory. The Conservatives did win the election, but to everyone's surprise, the jamming continued. The Mio 2 lifted her anchor and sailed across the North Sea to a new position off the Dutch coast. The jamming stopped. But now there was a new problem, because the Dutch authorities were also considering legislation against offshore radio. Radio Veronica, which had become a Dutch national institution, was concerned that RNI would put its own position in jeopardy, and secretly negotiated with RNI to close down. RNI duly did so in September of 1970.
Radio North is voluntarily closing down this morning at 11 o'clock. Due to the pressure on the Dutch Parliament to close down the offshore stations, our directors in Zurich feel that it would be better for the people of Holland for us to suspend broadcasting so that the Dutch government will not attempt to close down Radio Veronica, so dearly loved by the people of Holland for the past 10 years.
That was by no means the end of the story. In February of the following year, RNI resumed broadcasting, this time in Dutch as well as in English. This infuriated the owners of Radio Veronica, and one of them made an ill-advised decision to take the law into his own hands and force RNI off the air again.
This is Radio North Sea International. Anchored 4.5 miles from the coast of Scheveningen in Holland. I sound like this, I can't even say Scheveningen. Scheveningen, Holland, 4.5 miles from the coast by the radio ship Mordenay Veronica. We are on fire due to a bomb thrown on board from a motor launch. His identity we do not know, we didn't even see the launch.
RNI survived and continued broadcasting despite numerous problems. But it was on September 30th, 1972, that the next big development took place.
Yes, that was a busy day. Radio Veronica changed frequency from 1562 to 557 kHz. Radio North Sea International made a test transmission on Veronica's old frequency, and on 1187 kHz, we had the first transmissions for over 4 years from the Mi Amigo.
Some radio enthusiasts had bought the Mi Amigo for a bargain price and said they were going to equip it as an offshore radio museum. But one day, they sailed out of the harbour and into international waters, where additional work was carried out to restore the Mi Amigo to a fully working radio ship. Radio Caroline returned, this time with a format of album rock music at night and Dutch programmes during the day. Later, several other Dutch organisations hired airtime on the station, including Radio Atlantis and Radio Mi Amigo.
Atlantis here, Atlantis there, Atlantis in the air, Atlantis everywhere.
Compared with the original Radio Caroline, the 1970s version often sounded disorganized and unprofessional, mainly due to lack of money. But Buster Pearson, a dedicated Caroline listener since the beginning, sympathized with the staff who were doing their best under sometimes difficult conditions.
The magnetism of the station stems to a considerable extent from the fact it's coming from out at sea, and especially when you get the bad winter storms, you know, one's... Mine goes out to the disc jockeys struggling away there to bring us a programme of records, and I find it, hypnotic listening.
But conditions on board got worse, and in due course the inevitable happened. The crew were forced to abandon the Mi Amigo in heavy seas, and the ship sank. This left Western Europe without any offshore stations. But in the early 80s, rumours started circulating that another new radio ship was on the way. This turned out to be true when a former deep-sea fishing trawler called the Ross Revenge anchored in the Knock Deep Channel.
This is Caroline on 319, your all-day music station.
2 minutes past 11 our time, 2 minutes past 12 cloggy time. This is us. We're back.
And they're still with us. Two medium-wave transmitters are currently used, one of which carries the Dutch station Radio Monique in the daytime and religious programmes in the evening. But the enthusiasts group Anorax UK now report that a 10-kilowatt shortwave transmitter is reported to be testing on 6338 kilohertz, though a similar transmission last year later turned out to originate from a land-based enthusiast's garden near Nijmegen in Holland. In 1984, yet another new radio ship arrived in the Knock Deep Channel, close to the Ross Revenge.
From the MV Communicator, anchored
record and the international waters of the North Sea. We are Europe's hottest hits. AM 576. Laser Hot Hits.
Laser's format of top 40 hits and oldies proved very successful, but the station soon ran into financial difficulties. But how is it possible that a station can be so popular and still suffer money problems?
I think the main problem is that most of the people starting a radio station since, let us say, the coming of the Act in Holland 1974 have plans to make a lot of money in a short time instead of invest a lot of money during the first year and then making profits. And there are some very weird people behind the scene in the offshore radio history.
Not only weird people, but weird ideas too. Laser's problems weren't entirely financial.
No, they had technical ones too, and these ought to have been avoided. Somebody had the wonderful idea of using a helium balloon to support a vertical wire antenna. Great in theory, and it worked, for a time. But they'd forgotten that out in the North Sea, you often get force 9 gales, and of course the balloon broke loose, bringing down the antenna. And I believe the balloon ended up wrapped around a traffic bollard in Brussels.
So, wouldn't it be better if the offshore stations try to get a license to operate legally on land, thus removing all these hazards?
Master Pearson was adamant that he didn't want to see Radio Caroline come ashore.
No, I can't see that ever happening in this country. I wouldn't want to see it. I think if it once came onto dry land, it would lose all the glamour that it has at the moment from the Ross Revenge, or Holland's Revenge, as a lot of people are calling it.
Holland is the only country in the world where you can buy an offshore and free radio magazine on most newsstands. Does this mean that there's still a great interest in offshore radio here?
In Holland, then I mean people who are reading the offshore radio magazines, the radio magazines, are around 4,000. But listeners at the moment, an official poll says that nowadays 2.4 million people in Holland listen every week to Radio Monique more than half an hour.
Caroline and Monique from the Ross Revenge are the only offshore stations currently active. Four other potential projects could still blossom there. In Amsterdam Harbour, the owners of the former Radio Paradise say they're talking with potential buyers. Off the coast of Normandy, France, the MV Communicator is said to have been sold to new American backers who'll return with Laser. In a Spanish port, the Nanel project lies dormant, and only Roy Bates of Sealand knows if his plans for radio and television from a chunk of wartime concrete out there in the North Sea is really reality. But that's the offshore business for you. It's the rumours and occasional reality that keep the interest alive. More on offshore radio in a future programme, but now for a survey of shortwave radio conditions this past week, here's Mike Bird on the line from Melbourne.
We've experienced five solar flares, Jonathan, and the geomagnetic field has been unsettled for most of the week. Solar activity has been low to moderate, and three sunspot regions have been visible. Five solar flares have taken place, and they were on Friday the 7th at 1947 UTC, three on Saturday the 8th at 1:34, 3:38 and 1358 UTC, and finally on Sunday the 9th at 1357 UTC. Because of this increased solar activity, the solar flux has also risen. Flux levels have ranged between 83 and 97. The average works out to 92.2 and equals an effective sunspot number of 40. The geomagnetic field disturbance indicator, the A index, has ranged between 4 and 15, which are quiet to active conditions. Generally, the field has been unsettled up until yesterday when it became active due to a recurrent disturbance pattern.
Right, it's the 13th today. I hope you're not superstitious. A rather cool, dreary day in Hilversum. Have you got some good news for next week to cheer us up?
Well, I think conditions will be a little bumpy for the next day or two. And then hopefully conditions will then calm down. IPS Radio and Space Services expect that solar activity will be low to moderate. The geomagnetic field should be active or disturbed today and tomorrow, and then it should return to unsettled conditions on Saturday the 15th, and hopefully they will last the rest of the week.
Thanks, Mike. And that's it.
Years Ago Tomorrow was produced with the assistance of Andy Sennett, Roger Tidy, Tom DeMonk, Hans Knotts, and Earhart Kadane. It was presented by Jonathan Marks.